Friends, can I have your attention? Sounds like we're in an amphitheater, doesn't it? Thank you for attending tonight's 72nd Remembrance of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think in the popular news, not much. Oh, 72 years, has gone by, the problem is solved. No, in many ways we are very, very lucky because there's been a number of nuclear accidents. And, you know, you can only have luck for so long. Also, we are on the cusp of nuclear annihilation. When we have leaders that say that we can solve all of our problems with weaponry, and that we will not back down, we will not talk to others, that we end up being totally oblivious to people, other people, as being humane. And I remember years ago, a lady who was arrested for trespass in federal court said the Russians loved their children too. And I'm sure that the North Koreans and Iranians, the Middle Eastern, all the peoples, they love their children too. So this is an expression of love and hope. Now, I don't know, we only had about 50 programs entitled Lament and Sorrow, Hope for Tomorrow. And that program states that who all will be speaking and who the musicians are. And we have done this for the last 12 years. When I talk about we, it's PeaceWorks. And so there's a number of persons who are involved in the floating lanterns and in the program and taking pictures and setting things up. But it is really a community effort. And I think as a community, we mourn that so much vital resources are going to weaponry and war. We continue to make parts for nuclear weapons. We work to increase their efficiency, their deadliness, and yet we end up saying, why do we not have peace in our community? Why do the elderly and the ones without assets, why are they suffering? Why do we have a poor education? Why do we have so many things that we should have that are really inalienable for us? So the first person that is going to share with us is our poet laureate, Ron Faust. And he has brought a globe here with some of the floating lanterns nearby. And Ron has maybe 4 books or so of his poetry, and there is a table back there. And if you're interested in his books, have a look. And
thank you, Henry. We have here what was a symbolic globe of the Earth, and there's always forces that is trying to destroy the Earth. And what we're hoping to do with our community here is provide an affirmation in which we can save the Earth through enlightenment and through a community of peace. As we continue to pursue peace, I'm going to share with you a poem that I think, surprisingly enough, that's already in your bulletin, so you can follow along and be a poet reader too. Pursuing peace. To contemplate Hiroshima, I shudder. To imagine waking up on August 6, 1945 at 8:15 in the morning, to be gone. In an instant, once alive, now erased as a charred memory of a burnt, crispy, twisted ash heap. And I mourn. How any enemy deserves the unleashing of such fury, even though all equally disappear. Harming another is not okay. But pausing to remember this day implies a restraint on any bully, whoever owns nuclear weapons, otherwise a similar Hiroshima is not an option. That's why PeaceWorks calls for a ban on nuclear weapons. Let it be so. So, we are sending out a message to pulsate the heart waves that peace is already here. As we breathe it and dream it and pursue it. Let it be so.
Thank you, Ron. That was wonderful. As I said, he has four different books back there on a table. I was asked that if anyone would like to make a love offering for this Addicted to War. It's kind of in a comic book form, and it may be very attractive to young kids who may not know much about the subject. So if you would like to pitch in $1 or $2, they're on the information table. We have some of our newsletters. We have a membership form. There's also some books that I received from American Friends Service Committee because they're closing their office. And so those books are available there on the table for pickup. And please read them or pass them on so that they get used. Now, a dear friend of Jane and I is Michael McGrath, and this is the 72nd year. So he's going to do 72 gongs. Thank you, Michael. Our keynote speaker tonight is Jim Hanna.
Yeah, Mike, I caution you that some years ago, a friend of mine asked me to come to just visit one of the PeaceWorks Kansas City board meetings, and I thought, well, why not, you know? And that was about 7 years ago, and it's kind of been very active since then, and it's been a real blessing. Lament and sorrow, hope for tomorrow. This theme for tonight's commemoration is adapted from a haunting yet hopeful song with these lines. Give thanks for laments and psalms of sorrow that release our needed tears, that help us reach tomorrow and look beyond our fears. Lament and sorrow, hope for tomorrow. I commend you each for being here tonight. You've chosen to face into the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki rather than look away, as our nation mostly has done for the past 72 years. It's not easy to think the unthinkable or speak the unspeakable, especially in our officially optimistic society. We so often prefer to look on the bright side, ignoring the shadow side of ourselves and of our nation. When we first dropped the bomb, many of us were so happy that it helped end World War II that we didn't think much about the omnicidal threat we unleashed. And it's no wonder. From the very beginning of the atomic age, our military and political leaders have hidden from public view the true horrors of August 6th and August 9th, confiscating photos and films, suppressing the press, whatever was needed to keep public opinion from turning against these shiny new weapons of mass destruction and mass intimidation. That practice still continues. But tonight, we openly lament the global fallout of the atomic bombs these past seven decades. We lament the some 120,000 souls of Hiroshima and Nagasaki who died instantly, the tens of thousands who died later from injuries and from radiation poisoning, and the countless others who even today suffer from illness and trauma. We lament the more than 500 atmospheric nuclear tests which had poisoned our good Earth and our very bodies in ways that will not be known for years to come, making each of us unwitting and unwilling subjects in a global lab experiment. We lament the profligate waste of human resources that have been squandered on nuclear weapons estimated at more than $10 trillion since the beginning of the nuclear age. Even today, with the Cold War supposedly over, the global outlay for nuclear weapons is some $12 million an hour. $12 million an hour. With half that amount, it's estimated we could eliminate extreme poverty worldwide. And further, we lament the way nuclear weapons have set our moral compasses spinning. I remember my stepdad's stories about patrolling the West Coast during World War II, watching for Japanese submarines. We were fearful of even a single submarine attack, especially one that might target civilian populations like San Francisco or Seattle. Yet, were we once worried about even a single submarine armed with a few torpedoes, we now have become the enemy, as Walter Wink would say. With 14 nuclear-armed submarines, together carrying more than 1,000 nuclear warheads, each warhead 5 to 20 times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Do the math. That's at least 5,000 Hiroshimas. And that's just one of our three delivery systems, by land, by sea, and by air. These submarines are on secret patrol 24/7, capable of laying off any shore in the world, a so-called deterrent, holding the global population hostage to the threat of nuclear annihilation. For real, we think somehow we are deterring the use of nuclear weapons by clinging to the nearly 5,000 in our arsenal, and we think that somehow we're keeping the good faith promise we made to the world nearly 50 years ago to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons, while at the same time budgeting $1 trillion in the next 30 years to modernize the very weapons that we promised to eliminate. And we think that we're justified in using any means possible to stop other nations from joining our exclusive nuclear club, calling them rogue nations? Don't you have to wonder at a certain point who the rogue nations really are? Much of the world has resigned itself to the necessary evil of nuclear weapons, but many are waking up. These weapons are not necessary, they're just evil. They do not in any way fit the just war criteria of proportionality. How could nukes be proportional when they're not only indiscriminately genocidal, but also suicidal and omnicidal, capable of destroying ourselves and life as we know it on planet Earth? And so, yes, we lament. And we release our needed tears because we must not go numb. We must not become cynical or despair. As Washington Irving wrote long ago, there's a sacredness in tears. They are not the mark of weakness, but of power. They are messengers of overwhelming grief, of deep contrition, and of unspeakable love. But we need not only to sorrow, we also need to reach towards tomorrow and look beyond our fears. This is what you're doing already tonight by your presence here. You are the sign that we have not forgotten. You are the sign that hope is stronger than fear. You are the sign that the scourge of nuclear weapons will one day be delegitimized. And you are the voices that collectively will swell to an irresistible global chorus demanding no more nukes. This chorus is already beginning. Have you heard it? Time and again in the last 10 years, I've learned of yet another group somewhere in the world that's saying no to nukes of hazard. There are hundreds of such groups representing millions of members. Their work is often unseen, but there's a tipping point a-coming. A bit later tonight, you'll learn more about the recent United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, adopted by nearly two-thirds of the United Nations member nations. This treaty, and I quote, categorically prohibits the possession, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons. Can I hear a yes? All right. Nuclear weapons are already immoral. When ratified by 50 nations, this treaty will make them illegal. Could it happen? Public opinion and civil society have already effected international bans on chemical and biological weapons, landmines, and cluster mines. One fine day, nukes will be tossed on this growing heap of abandoned weapons of mass destruction, of mass deception. Our challenge this evening is to add our voices to the growing hosts around the world insisting no more nukes. Where do we start? No more nukes. Where do we start? I feel like the president. I feel like a Where do we start? How about with your friends? In recent weeks, I've asked many of my friends, many of them quite well informed, about, well, they've heard of the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and none of them had. Yet this may be the most singularly important forward step in our lifetimes to stop the existential menace of nuclear weapons. Let's get the word out there. Civil society, that's you and me and groups like Peaceworks and so forth, we can do what governments have failed to do. Historian Howard Zinn calls this a force more powerful, a grassroots effort that time and again has prevailed against all odds through nonviolent civil action. And guess what? Peace works. Like John Lennon, we need to imagine. Imagine a day when we invest more in peacemaking than in war making. Imagine a day when war and its weapons are done away. Imagine a day of true security, when basic needs are met for all. Imagine that day foreseen by prophets Jimi Hendrix and Mahatma Gandhi, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. And imagine that glad day when our grandchildren ask, Grammy, why did we ever have war? Or, Grandpa, what's a nuclear weapon? Could it happen? Absolutely. Through acts of imagination, through acts of resistance, we are a force more powerful. Tonight, together and individually, may we courageously and tirelessly live and declare the message of peace, salam, shalom, towards fulfillment of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki pledge, never again. Can you say it with me? Never again. One more time. Never again. Amen.
Jim, thank you. That was just excellent. I think that this piece, if you would like to read it, will be on PeaceWorks website. And so there's a chance to like run a copy or read it, pass it along to friends. I think that we have to be a little more bold in that some churches do not want to create controversy. And, you know, they're willing to take a position on abortion or something, but we need to say nuclear weapons is like a total abortion of the world. We need to say this needs to be preached as the gospel of nonviolence, as Father Charles McCarthy does. So our next person is Michael McGrath, and he will be playing "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple." And, you know, I was always confounded by this because I think it's an old Quaker or Shaker song. But Walter Cronkite, for years, did his program at 5 or 6 in the evening. And it was in with a militaristic, you know, cymbals and drums and everything, when that was totally the opposite spirit where it originally came from.
I thought that he was talking about it. I thought I'd just read the first verse. 'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn, turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right. And I thought maybe this was, in the program it says, 'tis a gift to be simple, Michael McGrath, but it's really, 'tis a gift to be by simple Michael McGrath.
Thank you.
Beautiful, Michael. Thank you. Turn where we ought to be. Yes, you're welcome. A special friend that we have gotten to know in maybe the past 6-7 years is Gail June. And Gail June will tell you that his mother lived in Hiroshima and was present on the day of the bombing. And she was working underground at the time, and she passed away a few years ago. And so Gail has, what? Oh, Nagasaki, I am sorry. And when you see these cranes here, this wonderful array of cranes that has been donated to the Community of Christ, Gail put those together in honor of his mother. And a few years back, I was out at the Truman Presidential Library, and Gail and his wife were some of the honored guests, as well as an ambassador from Japan, as well as Truman Daniels, who is a grandson of Harry Truman. And you would think, you know, that yes, we are all in accord. Never again, never more shall this happen. So, Gail.
Hello there. It's good to see a lot of your faces here again. I guess this is my 6th or 7th time speaking here, so anyway, thank you. And I want to thank Jane and Henry for inviting me to speak again. I'm going to include excerpts of my previous talks for the benefit of the newcomers here, so they can hear my mother's story newly. If you remember some of these paragraphs from years past, please forgive me. My name is Gail June, and I'm the eldest son of Michiko June, a survivor of the Nagasaki A-bombing, a vanishing group of people the Japanese called the Hibakusha, or the explosion-affected people. At first feared and rejected, they are now deeply respected throughout the world for their perseverance and strength. It's been 6 years since my mother's passed away. But she's present here today in many hearts and in the words I have to share with you. For those that knew her well, she did not fit the model of the traditional demure Japanese woman. At 4'10", she was small, but she was mighty. She was born in Nagasaki, Japan on October 6th, 1926, in the year of the Fire Tiger. My daughter is a Fire Tiger, so I have some experience with what my father had to deal with. Now, her father, Yasuga Okada, was a physician in Nagasaki, and she was afforded an upper-tier education where she studied art and literature. She was familiar with the classics, played the piano, enjoyed classical and big band music. She appreciated fine art and design. She attended Methodist Missionary College, learned English and German, converted to a radical new religion called Christianity, and continued her studies until the war began, when every citizen was required to help in the war effort. Our mother, at the age of 18, was at the epicenter of a major world event. She was present at the Mitsubishi Torpedo Factory on August 9, 1945, ground zero for the second atomic bomb to be dropped in Japan. The necessity of that event is still being debated today. But for our mother who lived through it, this is her story. Toward the end of the war, there were very few able-bodied men left to work the factories. So many women and children and elderly were required to fill in working in the munitions plants. Fortunately, her area of the factory was moved underground into underground tunnels weeks before, and she and her co-workers survived the blast. Even though they were underground, she said they were aware of the flash. After about 8 hours of waiting, Michiko, her best friend Taki, and several others were allowed to leave. They exited the tunnels to find the entire downtown gone and smoldering. It was a nightmare, the closest thing to a zombie apocalypse. People were burnt, bleeding, their clothes ripped away, burnt away, moaning for water, for relief. They stopped at the river's edge to bring a bucket of water for a family before moving on. Please think about that as you set these lanterns in the water for this beautiful pond. All that was left were the streetcar tracks that they followed to get home. Her neighborhood, which was 3.5 kilometers away from the hypocenter, and this map sort of shows where she was, where Ground Zero was, and where her home was. And she basically had to walk through Ground Zero to get to her home. Now, her neighborhood, which was 3.5 kilometers from the hypocenter, was protected from the blast because it was at the base of a mountain. And when she got home, her father was upstairs in their home shrine praying for the daughter he thought he'd lost. The next days had to be indescribable. Her father was credited with creating one of the first triages on the scene. Mama described the marking of patients, ones that would require immediate attention, ones that could be saved, and ones that had no hope. She was heartbroken to see them put the hopeless patients next to the dead ones. In the weeks to follow, people and friends that survived the blast and appeared healthy started becoming ill, passing blood, losing their hair, developing sores, a result of the radiation poisoning caused by the radioactive fallout all around. I believe if her father was not a doctor, she and her family may not have survived. She met my father, Sergeant Gallerjun, who was an American GI stationed in Nagasaki for the reconstruction effort at a USO-sponsored square dance. He was assigned to rebuilding the trust and goodwill between the occupation forces and the Japanese population. I would really like to acknowledge our father, her husband. From the stories he's told us, he was just a hot-blooded 17-year-old from Tuscumbia, Missouri, and had joined the Army just for the glamorous glory of it. His belief at the time was commonly shared by many Americans after Pearl Harbor, that the Japanese were very evil and backward people. What he found when he arrived was one of the most beautiful places he'd ever seen. Ancient temples and gardens, amazing buildings with expert craftsmanship, a functioning society that was working in harmony with nature. Quite a contrast to the Depression-era sharecropper existence in the backwoods of the Ozarks. He fell in love with the people, the culture, and the beauty of Japan. It was a life-transforming experience for him, and while he could identify with the victors of the war, he saw firsthand the tremendous cost that was paid by the mostly civilian population. Perhaps his marrying a Japanese woman and creating a life and a family with her was his personal atonement for what happened. Those of you from 2 years ago, I shared about my origami project that I created. And I began a conversation to honor my mother with 1,000 origami cranes to be placed over her gravestone. But I wanted these cranes to come from every corner of the world, represent every continent, every country, every religion, every culture, and every race. Anyone that desired to inherit a world free of the possibility of nuclear war, I wanted to be part of this endeavor. So I received 1,600 cranes from six continents in 10 weeks. They came from all over the world, even from Los Alamos, the birthplace of the weapon that was dropped on my mother's home 69 or 72 years ago. That a symbol of peace and love in the form of a fragile paper crane could come full circle to honor the memory of a survivor 72 years later gives me hope. What I learned from this project is we are not alone. There are people all over the world that want this very thing. There's a conscious recognition of the terrible wrongness of using this technology for the annihilation of human beings. The amount of love, concern, and a desire to free the world from these terrible weapons is overwhelming. And I felt that there are really more people out there like that than we realized. and I want you to really get that. There's an awakening that says we are more powerful than our past suggests. As human beings, we're all connected. And the worst disease affecting humanity is not heart disease, it's not cancer, but fear and self-righteousness. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, we can transform the world. Buckminster Fuller said, to change something, build a new model that makes the existing one obsolete. To end nuclear weapons, we need to remove the perceived need for them. And that will require a change in worldview. And to transform worldview, it helps to look at humanity as a conversation. There are millions of conversations going on in the world every second. Conversations that create, conversations that destroy. We create our worlds by the type of conversations that we generate. In a way, we create each other by the words we speak. I am who I am by the way my parents spoke to me, my teachers spoke to me, my friends spoke to me, etc. In a way, speaking is an act of creation. But the conversations we create are profoundly limited to our worldview, the way we see the world. We can't really see outside of that. Our worldview is our reality for us. It's the reality that gives us comfort and a sense of rightness. Our worldview then generates the actions that we make day to day. And those actions create our world. And let me give a small example. There are two war veterans who lost both their legs in battle. One has the worldview that I am less a man without my legs. His worldview will generate anger, self-pity, despair, which leads to actions of drinking, drug abuse, and finally death. The second veteran's worldview is, I am more than just my legs. And his view generates appreciation, gratefulness, determination. His actions include fitting for blade prosthetics, retraining and rehabilitation, and eventually running a marathon. Two different results from the same circumstances, just because of the worldview each person had, the conversation in their head. Now today there appears to be two opposing views in the world, and you can see it in our political discourse. One is the Darwinian survival of the fittest versus leave no one behind, or we don't survive unless we all survive. Which one is right? It depends on your worldview. This is where we need to alter the conversation. The question to ask is, what kind of world do you want to live in? What kind of world do you want for your children and for your grandchildren? What kind of world are we committed to creating? We confuse force with power, but the truth is, people who lack power need force. Truly powerful people need no force, because real power is love. This is where we need to transform the worldview from fear to love, from scarcity to abundance, from we don't have enough to we have too much, and there is enough for everybody. I've had the privilege to visit the Memorial Peace Park in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Engraved in the memorial in Hiroshima, there are the names of the victims that are recorded in the Book of the Past, is the inscription, "Let all the souls here rest in peace, for we shall not repeat the evil." With forgiveness, let that chapter be complete. You, with all our family, share the hopes that August 9th, 1945, was the last time humankind ever used this insane weapon on itself. And each chime of that gong, for me, is a cause for celebration that we've gone another year without the use of this terrible weapon. Thank you all for standing in the possibility with your kind listening and your acknowledgement of one loving soul who survived the darkness and the thousands who did not. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Mary Ladke, another wonderful member of Peaceworks, and she's going to be talking about this UN treaty banning nukes.
I'm going to talk to you just briefly about the hopeful news of the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. On July 7th of this year, a global treaty entitled Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was adopted at the UN headquarters in New York City. This global treaty was finalized by 122 nuclear weapons-free countries, representing two-thirds of the 192 member countries of the United Nations. This treaty prohibits the possession, development, testing, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons. This treaty opens for signature on September 20th and enters into legal force 90 days after being ratified by 50 countries. The participants to this treaty did not include any of the world's nine nuclear armed countries. That's the United States, UK, France, China, Russia, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel, along with their allies. Those were the only states that did not participate. In a joint statement released after the treaty was adopted, the US, Britain, and France said, "We do not intend to sign, ratify, or ever become a party to it." Proponents of the treaty never expected any nuclear-armed country would sign it, at least not at first. Rather, supporters hope the treaty's widespread acceptance elsewhere will eventually increase the public pressure and stigma of harboring and threatening to use such weapons of unspeakable destruction and make holdouts reconsider their positions. The treaty is really rooted in humanitarian law, and it does provide a path for nuclear-armed states to join at a later date. The countries supporting this treaty know that nuclear warfare knows no boundaries, makes no distinction between soldier and civilian, and they know any large-scale war would endanger the lives of hundreds of millions of human beings. They know that a crisis like the one now growing in North Korea could leap from a spark to an uncontrollable inferno in unanticipated ways. With the nuclear-armed states opposed to any such treaty, it will be a long road to the elimination of nuclear arsenals via a route still largely uncharted. Our work is cut out for us. We must oppose the administration's plan to spend $1.2 trillion of our taxpayer dollars on modernization of its nuclear arsenal. We must demand that nuclear-armed governments stop threatening and start talking to adversaries. This is of utmost importance, even when prospects for resolution of conflicts seem most dim. It is incumbent on the most powerful governments to take the initiative. We must support this new treaty by pressuring our elected officials with our calls, letters, in-person visits, and in the streets, demanding that they work to eliminate nuclear weapons from our world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And again, not waiting for any particular country to take the lead, but it's really the people of the world that are coming forward to say this must happen. If we are to survive, if we are to be truly humane, then this must happen. We are going to conclude now with Lauren Hall leading us in song. Hold on. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped over an important part, working for peace and justice. This is Lee Woody.
Hi. We have upcoming events on Tuesday the 8th. We have considering voting yes on question 3, which is to support a living wage of $15 per hour. On August 8th, we also have a memorial prayer vigil, which he mentioned earlier, which is the same time as the Nagasaki bombing. On August 10th, we have a podcast discussion, which is by Serge KC, which is Showing Up for Racial Justice. That will be at the St. Mark Church at 3800 Troost. Also, on the 21st of August, there is a mass surge meeting at the Second Presbyterian Church at 318 East 55th Street. And then we have on August 20th through the 26th, Women's Equality Week, which has Faith in Action, Equality Week picnic, and then the Loose Park Shelter, and then Crossing the Gender Divide in the Workplace. And then we also ask you to talk to your Congress about taking nuclear weapons off alert, adopt a no first use policies, and end modernization of nuclear weapons, make cuts in the nuclear stockpiles, end deployment of nuclear weapons abroad, and support the UN Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And there's a whole list of senators and representatives if you would like to see it and their phone numbers.
The list of representatives is in the program. And this is Lauren Hall.
And in the peace and quiet of this beautiful park that we've been in this evening, there is hope for tomorrow. And I'd like us to join in singing a prayer song. It's a Navajo prayer song. And let's learn it in the way that it was given to us in the world by the Navajo Nation. And we'll do that orally and by rote. I'll sing it once through, and we'll just continue to join together in our voices and lift up that hope for tomorrow. Peace before us, peace behind us, peace under our feet. Peace above us, peace within us, let all around us be peace. Peace before us, peace behind us, peace under our feet. Peace above us, peace within us, let all around us be peace. Peace before us, peace behind us, peace under our feet. Peace above us, peace within us, let all around us be peace. For those of you who can stand and do these motions with me, or sit and do the motions with your arms, we will leave this as our prayer for this evening. Peace before us, peace behind us, peace under our feet. Peace above us, peace within us, let all around us be peace. Peace before us, peace behind us, peace under our feet. Peace above us, peace within us, let all around us be peace.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for continuing to work peace. We're working on peace, for peace, in all the different ways that you do. If it's possible to maybe help carry.
The United Nations, and PSR was asking, Physicians for Social Responsibility was asking if those of you who know how to tweet, which I haven't figured out yet, but anyway, if you could send a, there's a picture on their site that says, no more Hiroshima, support the nuclear ban for, ban nuclear weapons for, and then write down for my children, for the earth, for whatever. Take your picture and then tweet it to her between August 6th to the 11th. They're trying to get as many citizens of the United States to let her know that we support the ban.
And this is U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
Right. And her, it says, first sign ban nuclear weapons for, put it across, take your picture, then, I just lost it. Then send it, if you go to the PSR site, it'll show you how to do it. So that's what I would suggest, because it gives you the how you send it to her, the handle or whatever, okay?
Thank you. PSR's Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn, Ann Swellentrop and others are members of the local chapter. Thank you.